folks, welcome to this special again edition of Five to Go here live at the Georgia Racing Hall of Fame in sunny, today anyway, Dawsonville, Georgia. Dan, you brought the beautiful weather with you. We finally brought the show to you once again.
I think the humidity is what you brought to me. I don't know what it is, but yeah, if you can spin that camera around and take a look at what we're looking at here, this is pretty darn awesome as far as what memorabilia is in here and what automobiles are in here.
It certainly is. So this is one of those places, the Georgia Racing Hall of Fame, which is on Highway 53, about 10 minutes, less than 10 minutes west of Georgia 400 here in Dawson County. This is what the capital of racing was many years ago, back before there was Daytona, before there was Charlotte.
It was just a cornfield right out there, and that's where the racing was. Well, the racing in the moonshine all started in the cornfield.
So that's correct.
You picked the corn first, and then you went and raced in the cornfield.
That's what we did. And so what we're doing here today is we're dedicating we're inducting five different people into the Georgia Racing Hall of Fame. We've got Tammy Jo Kirk. We're going to describe each one of these later on. Randy Holt, short track racer. Biddle Ridley, I know Dan has a lot of stories about him. That's Jody's brother, right?
Yes, that's it.
And Bob Wright as well. We've also got our driver of the year, Bubba Pollard, who won a couple of years ago. The Jimmy Ma Stellar Media Award to Motorsport America's Fred Hanion. Bernard Long, the Pioneer Award, who does a lot here at the Hall of Fame. We're going to honor some of the people we've lost. And then we get to dedicate, and at the end of the day, Dan, and we're dedicating a very special piece right to – we're actually set up broadcasting right next to this. If you're watching on Facebook Live, Joe Williams, my dad mentor, Joe Williams, has shown us the library that we're dedicating for Jimmy Mosteller and Captain Herb Emery. Now, for those that have listened to this podcast, you have heard a lot about Captain Herb. We're going to talk more about him, especially in a moment when his wife Karen Emery, his widow Karen, joins us. But, Dan, we need to explain to people who Jimmy Mosteller is. And if you care about racing at all, you have to have an appreciation for this guy.
Yeah, little Jimmy Mosteller. And the first I remember of Jimmy is as a kid, all I remember about him is he always had a half a Tampa. He always had a cigar in his mouth. And if you went to any of the short tracks around, I guess you heard him commentate the race, and he did such a good job. So of those people that you grew up knowing and you grew up with that voice kind of ringing in your head after the race was over, describing all the events that went on during the evening of racing, that was Jimmy.
And what Jimmy left such an impression on the Georgia racing community that even before that before this dedication here at the library, there was already the Jimmy Mosteller Media Award that Fred Hanion's going to win this year. And the first recipient of that award after his passing away several years ago was Captain Herb Emery.
Yep.
And so to kind of bring those things, tie them together, and have them put in a library is really special. And so what they've done here, if you've been up to the Racing Hall of Fame before but maybe haven't been in the last few months, they have taken the T-shirt trailer, essentially, that they have had, this little mini trailer, and they put the souvenir shop elsewhere, and they've carved it out and made it to be a desk and a dedication for Herb and Jimmy. And so they have a bunch of different old racing books, a lot of the old Winston Cup yearbooks, and then they have some great pictures of Captain Herb and Jimmy Mosteller, and a video that's running on loop of some interviews that Herb's done over the years and some reports and things. And
I was telling Karen about how many photos that I have going to the racetrack through the 80s, through the 90s, through the early 2000s of even you in those photographs with Captain Herb and Karen. And it's amazing that most of the photos I have of Karen, she's always looking the other way or her hands over her face, or I wouldn't know her any other way.
She's never been one for the spotlight, all right? But and for those who wonder about Karen, was it just
Captain
Herb?
Yeah, but I'm so proud of the pictures, the fact that you have the photos. I'm so proud of that, and you never know how valuable those are until you get later in life and you look back on those photos at the times and the places and the things that went on. And the happy times.
They really were the happy times. And I've only been involved
because Captain Herb was in his element.
Anytime we were at a racetrack or at a festival or the Hall of Fame, that was Herb and his deal. And so one of the things, continuing the legacy that we've got to do, we continue this podcast. This is the idea for it, the kind of rubric for it, if you will. The Hot Rod Lincoln, that came out of Captain Herb's racing show.
He laid all the groundwork. He laid the foundation for everything that we're doing today. And as you say, it's all in honor of him.
Yeah, absolutely. We do this as a passion project because we love racing and we love Captain Herb. Mm-hmm. Captain Herb also, his racing remotes to me, especially that he did at Atlanta Motor Speedway, are so quintessential. And we don't have quite as many wires strung out here, but we tried to display the element of organization.
Yeah, but you brought us into the digital age and most of that.
I did. So. I tried, yeah. I tried for sure. But Herb, whenever.
Because this would be a huge camera in front of us, video, and where you could somewhere show that at a later point in time. Or it just goes into the archives.
By the time I got involved in 2004, NASCAR had become popularity-wise to a whole other level. But when Herb first started doing the show in the mid-90s, I think 1994, this was kind of as you were coming out of the mighty 80s for the Elliott family. I mean, NASCAR was a little – it was getting really popular, but it still had a folksy element, and I think that matched perfectly with Herb's personality.
It did. Everything kind of fit like a glove. And I was going to ask you, knowing Captain Herb as well as we both did, what would Captain think about racing today? What would his thoughts and words be on where we're at? You know, because he's always looking, Captain Herb always looked at the positive side of everything. I never heard Captain Herb say anything on the negative side of anything.
Well, until Toyota showed up.
Yeah, but we know that he was always joking around with us at Kyle Lapile and Toyota and so forth. But still,
I think
he really didn't have anything bad to say.
I think he had some of the same reservations that we expressed from time to time on this podcast of just the one thing that, and this was true through his career as a traffic reporter, he always was looking for the person that may have been slightly forgotten, the person that needed
That's the little guy.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard
always
to say.
Always
the Georgia drivers, right? Mm-hmm. So to bring it to the local level. So I think it was very hard for Captain Herb to look at racing out as now with the charter system and with needing millions of dollars to run 30th and think that the little guy was being taken care of, hundreds of dollars to go to a race weekend for a fan. I think he has a lot of the same gripes that the generation that's really disgruntled with NASCAR right now has.
Yeah, probably so, but we can't deny that the racing is still good. We can't deny that the fact that you've got a lot of talented young drivers. You've got a lot of drivers from around the area that are doing extremely well, and we want them to do good, and we want to do like Captain Herb. We want to keep promoting and pushing the local drivers.
We certainly do. So this is big. So today here at the Georgia Racing Hall of Fame, that's why we're here. One guy that gave some Georgia drivers a big lift and also was pretty instrumental in the career of one of the most legendary drivers racing right now, Billy Ballou. Skipped his name when I was like, why are there only four? The page was stuck together. I knew I was forgetting somebody.
I was wondering when you were going to get to Billy. I thought there would be a special part of this for him.
So he's from Blue Ridge, Georgia. And what I want to do is, just like we did on this podcast a couple of months ago,
Blue Ridge is in Georgia.
I believe so. There's a Blue Ridge. Yeah, I believe so. I think this
it
is what,
better be.
This is what this says, and okay. I'm going by what this says. No, I'm just kidding. So we ran over these nominee or these inductees a couple of weeks ago or a few months ago, but I wanted to just kind of give you an idea of who's getting into this Hall of Fame. And to me, the biggest name that's coming in that people maybe in NASCAR would know if you follow the sport for the last 15 years is Billy Ballou. He was owner of the Camper World Truck Series, or now the Gander Outdoors Truck Series, and really what took him to notoriety was not fielding a truck for Shane Sieg.
No.
It was or Bill Lester, another Georgia driver. It was what a certain kid named the Shrub was able to do in that number 15 and that 51. Mm-hmm. Kyle Busch ran, let's see, so he won, by the way, he won 20
You're
races
about Rowdy
as a
truck. Bush, aren't you?
Kyle Rowdy Bush, yeah.
Yep.
See, he won 20 races as an owner, and most of those were with Kyle Busch at the wheel.
Yep.
He also gave Eric Almirola his only Truck Series victory, too. And he's had Martin Truex drive for him. He's run some ARCA races. 365 races he's run in trucks. And was, I think, the perfect example, Dan, of a guy, got some money, I've got a business, I'm going to put a truck team together and go to the track and race. And it wasn't tied to a big corporation.
That's it. It was Billy is something else. What a personality. When you look at Billy, and I can't wait to see how he's dressed when he comes in today, because if he don't have shorts on and orange tennis shoes, I'm going to be surprised.
And don't you think his speech is going to be pretty good?
Yeah, to say the least, this will be up here in the top five probably of all the speeches.
The top five today?
The top five of all the speeches that's ever been done here at the Hall of Fame since they started inducting.
Oh, that's fantastic. We look forward to seeing Billy Ballou here. He's somebody that I've interacted with on social media a little bit every once in a while. I don't know that I've ever had a conversation with him in person. We haven't crossed paths.
You don't have
much.
A conversation with Billy. You just listen.
Okay, great. Well, that'll be perfect for me. All right. So
you just listen, because he is a conversation, and he has so much to say about so many different things. And the thing about it is he's gone through all these different all experiences and all the things that he's gone through. There is so much that he knows that to tell all the stories, I don't know how long we're going to be here today, but this is going to be interesting.
We're told there's a 5-minute clock of these speeches. We'll see.
Yeah, I don't know that Billy's clock is up to speed.
Well, for anybody that's watching on Facebook Live here, Joe, we got anybody tuned in? Got a few people? Oh, Momo's watching. What's up, girl? It's my girlfriend. Excellent. Well, thank you all for watching. If anybody's in the area or knows people.
Tiffany Robinson, John Clark.
Oh, Johnny Clark, the announcer of Dixie Speedway,
wow,
is watching. I saw
hello,
him comment
Johnny.
There. Yeah, Johnny's been the boy. John should be up here getting some hardware
exactly.
At some point, don't you think?
That's exactly right.
So we invite anybody that you know that's watching to come up here, pay the money to go to the ceremony. This ceremony is a big thing to help keep the Hall of Fame open.
I told Daryl not to call me while I was on the radio.
You're so funny. You're so funny. Yeah, Daryl Waldron. Yeah, he probably just listened
boogity
to this
boogity,
week's episode.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but come up here, and even if you don't get a chance to want to go in the ceremony, just look at the cars, come to the distillery, and have a look at this new Jimmy Mosteller and Captain Herb Library. It's a lot of fun. We're also gearing up, by the way, before we talk about some more inductees. Coming up during Labor Day race weekend, or Labor Day weekend, I should say, August the 31st, we got the big annual Labor Day car show up here. Registration's only $20, and vendors could come here and get space for $20 as well, and that benefits the Georgia Racing Hall of Fame. And then later on, Dan, we're going to talk to some of your kin from CARE about the Dawsonville Moonshine Festival coming up this fall.
All right. Are they bringing samples back?
Well, the sample's right around the corner over there. In fact, I was hoping that I'd have some on the air, because this is a broadcast. So we can just do whatever we want, you know.
All right.
It's a little different, all right, if you have a little
lubrication. They do still have a jail here. So
that's good. And they have a fake one in here, I believe, actually. So our next inductee, we're going to talk about Tammy Jo Kirk. And my familiarity, Dan, with Tammy is really at the end of her NASCAR career, running a couple of then Busch truck races. But she got her big start in motorcycles, which I think is just BA, man. I mean, motorcycles are a whole different deal. I think it takes a different level of daredevil to get on two wheels and be that exposed.
Yeah, that's a whole different level of pain to me is motorcycles, because you don't just wreck or fall off a motorcycle. They usually wallow you to death on the way down.
Yeah, exactly right. And we, by the way, for those that aren't familiar, Georgia Racing Hall of Fame, this is not just stock cars. It's not just drivers. It's owners, crew chiefs, mechanics, amongst all disciplines of racing. And so we have motorcycle racers, sports car racers, and people in here. So it's some great stories, people that you've never heard of that have been transformational in the spine of motorsports. Tammy Jo Kirk had an AMA actually Grand National Championship and became the first woman to reach the finals at Knoxville in their half mile there in 1983. And then Jody Ridley, who's a Hall of Fame member here, we're going to talk about his brother in a moment, urged her to go late model racing. She was the most popular driver in the now defunct NASCAR Slim Jim All-Pro division in 1994. And then she actually won the Snowball Derby in 1994. That's a good sponsorship, you know. But she won the Snowball Derby in 1994. Dan, let's stop there. We need to talk about the Snowball Derby.
Yeah.
Winning the Snowball Derby, what does that mean to somebody that doesn't know much about motorsports, like my girlfriend who's watching?
You know, that to the short track drivers, winning the Snowball Derby would be the equivalent of a Cup driver winning Daytona.
Yeah.
In February. That would be the equivalent, because it is the place to be. It's the place to be recognized, and if you're any driver at all, you've probably won the Snowball Derby, and that is high on your resume.
Yeah, it really is. So we've seen when Eric Jones won the Snowball Derby and outran Kyle Busch to do that, that That's why Eric Jones is a Cup driver now, essentially. Johanna Long won the Snowball Derby, and I think that went a long way in, for the time being, keeping your NASCAR career going.
That's it.
Any driver that's won it, you know, Chase has won it a couple of times. It's
the who's who of drivers that want to move on up the ladder, and most that have won the Snowball Derby have moved on up the ladder and done extremely well.
So this didn't parlay into NASCAR success necessarily for Tammy Jo Kerr, but she did run the 1997 season in the Truck Series with Jeff Bodine Racing, so she got aligned with a driver of ilk. And she was able to continue her career by doing a female driver's program and actually working with country music legend Loretta Lynn to do that. So she's paid her blessing forward even after the racing part kind of finished up. So props to Tammy Jo Kirk. Another inductee that we're putting in is Randy Holt. Now, Dan, outside of what did you have any dealings with Randy Holt?
Yeah, I did. I had a little bit in the beginning because I did some transmission gear work for Randy. I know Ernie did some engine work for Randy. So, yeah, we were friends for a long time. And Randy's another one of the drivers that put together a great effort and probably one of the drivers that very few ran Fords, but Randy was a Ford man.
And no wonder y'all did so much work for them. We know that Elliott was a Ford family for sure. So he's out of Peachtree City, and he bought his first race car, and it was in 77 he bought this race car, and it was raced by Tiny Lund. So he's a big Wood Brothers fan, a big David Pearson fan. Tiny Lund, as we all know, won a Daytona 500 for the Wood Brothers. Tie that all together. And so he numbered that race car 21.
Yep.
And he went on and through his early career, started getting his feet going. But then in 1986, when he switched to asphalt racing, its switch was on. He won 19 of 25 races at Sonoy Raceway in 1992. Yep. And overall had 150 feature wins in his career.
Wow.
And you think about it, I mean, 150 wins. If you win one race a week, that's 3 years worth of racing.
3 years worth of racing.
Yeah, that you win
exactly
every time.
Right.
So you sprint. I know they could race multiple times in a week and all that, but that's pretty doggone impressive.
That is really impressive because we know a lot of drivers that have come through the series and not won that many events in more years.
A lot more years.
A lot
right?
more years.
And he his final race, the last deal here, it was a NASCAR Legends race in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and he got to race against David Pearson.
I started to say, I bet he raced against David Pearson.
Yeah.
And that was probably racing against his mentor, hero, and probably one of the people that he loved the best.
And I would think that's got to be, it doesn't matter, if you know you're not going to win the Daytona 500 or win at your home track at Atlanta, you know, be a cut driver, that getting to race against your idol has got to be
number one on the list.
Who were some of the people that you as the Elliott family idolized and tried to size yourself up against or wanted to be like? Like, who did you put up on that pedestal and say, if I could only get to that level, I would have...
Would that be Jody Ridley?
Jody Ridley, okay.
Yeah, absolutely, because you look at that, you look at all the drivers that were around here that ran extremely well. Even Gordon Jones, you know, Gordon has got some memorabilia here in the Hall of Fame also. And when you look at all the drivers around here that you grew up knowing, even down to Doug Kenemer, Bud Lunsford. You look at all these drivers around here. It was something to go against them, to race against them. And then when you got better in your career and started winning races and beating those people, it's like this is – it can't get any better.
No, that's – I would think – and I'm trying to think – when I got to – I'm trying to – obviously I'm not a race car driver. So in my career – I mean, Captain Herb was that mark, and he was the person that got me in. You know, it would sort of be like, oh, what do I want to be like if I'm a race car? I want to be like Rick Hendrick, or Rick Hendrick hired me to drive. So here I am with Rick. I got to immediately work with people that I idolized before I even knew that's what I wanted to do as my career. Frankly, I didn't know that I necessarily wanted to be.
I think Captain Herb drafted you.
He said, you're going to do this. Yeah. But to sit there, and for me, just in my small world, to get to work next to people that year after year, we have people going into the Georgia Radio Hall of Fame, whether it's Scott Slade or Kurt Mellish or Sabrina Cupid or Chris Camp or the people that you hear on WSB, Mark Arum. I mean, even, you know, Mark, I've worked 15 years now. It's crazy to think I still consider myself like, how am I getting to work with these people? It's pretty cool.
Because you earned it and you deserve it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And it's honestly, that, I mean, as a kid, you know, as a kid in high school, middle school, whatever, watching NASCAR, think like I'm sitting here at the George Racing Hall of Fame getting to hang out with Elliott. That's pretty cool.
Hey.
So, hey, what's up, Dan?
Mark that one off the bucket
exactly.
list.
Exactly. Exactly. So you mentioned Jody Ridley before. Let's get to the next 2019 Georgia Racing Hall of Fame inductee, Biddle Ridley. And I remember we talked about it a few weeks ago on the podcast. You had a lot to say about Biddle.
Biddle was something else. You know, the whole family, when you first start going to the racetrack, to the short tracks, and you see Jody, you know, you don't know many of the other people that come with the teams at that time because the stars were obviously the drivers. So when you start seeing the other members of the teams and you start putting all the faces together and you find out how important these people are in the careers of the people, of the drivers, and how important these people are because Biddle Worm, he worked on the cars. He did as much stuff as Jody did. He just didn't drive the cars early in his career.
Well, right. So he drove and then did great, and then switched over and was even better. And I think that's cool. And so, you know, one thing that's a rub about the drivers now is they don't know much about the race cars, right? I mean, that's kind of a
When you look at the drivers today, I don't know how much the crew chiefs know today.
That's true.
But because
that's
you talk just like
crew
I said about
managers, yeah.
Just like I talked about Jimmy Finney coming to Gresham, and they were there with Roush, and they were doing the different setups on the cars. I asked Jimmy. I said, "What can you? What do you have the ability to change on your own merit here? What can you change on the car to tweak it a little bit for the driver?" He said, "Dude, I call the engineers and they send me a thumb drive with all the setup on the car, and we plug that into the computer, and that's what it is."
That's tough.
And that's tough. And I said, "You have no input." He said, "Well, I can give input, but," he said, "as far as making the changes, I can't make the changes."
That's crazy. And to think this is a guy that was a crew chief for Bobby Allison,
forever.
Mark Martin.
Yeah, forever. And the experience and the knowledge that these people have, it's unbelievable.
It really is. And so, but I think about it. So NBC has taken over the NASCAR coverage this week. And we'll talk a tiny bit about NASCAR today. This is really about the Georgia Racing Hall of Fame. And I'm relating this to Biddle really because he went from driver to crew chief. Mm-hmm. So they did this deal, and it was staged, but where they had this kid come up and ask the drivers questions at this big promotional shoot that they do with all the drivers for NBC. And this kid comes up and asks some softball questions, like who are you going to sit with at lunch and all this stuff. But then she asks a really technical question about the aero. I can't remember what it was. It was about the aerodynamics on the car. No, I know. She asked them what a tapered spacer was. How does it restrict airflow? Yep. And so the initial drivers were, they did this. She asked Kyle Busch. He knew it to a T. He goes, and I'm saying he knew it. I don't know it, but I'm saying he goes, "Well, it's a cone-shaped thing, and it goes in the throttle body, and air," he goes, "air plus gas makes fire, and this restricts the air, so you have less fire, therefore less power." Mm-hmm. If you listen to Kyle Busch on the radio, in comparison to some of the other drivers, not only will you hear a lot more different letter bombs, but you'll also hear him talk exactly about what's going on with the race car to where, and I know he's not allowed to make those changes, but he knows he can drive.
He knows because look at the experience coming up from all the levels he's come through. He's driven about everything, and the thing about that is he's been successful in most everything. And that's what a lot of drivers, you know, they might find a niche along the way. We might start off in go-karts. We might go on to legends. We might come through and drive pretty much everything known to man. But each one pretty much has a niche that they fall into that they love, and they excel in whatever series that is. But Kyle, you stick him in anything, and he pretty much excels no matter what. You know, I'd hate to go up and say, "I challenge you to a foot race," because I'd probably get my butt beat.
Hey, he'd figure out how to aerodynamically trim out his shoes to do that. You know, he'd pin back those floppy ears, you know, or something.
I'd say he'd get them in the breeze and they would be pinned back.
It really is. And you know, you hear drivers openly say, like Kyle Larson, for instance. I mean, and honestly, if I were a driver, this is how I'd want to be. Let me drive the car. You guys set it up. I make it go fast.
Well, if you can't have any input in what the car setup is, then does it matter anymore other than the communication between you and whoever makes those changes, that to me now is the most important thing, and that's where we've evolved from to where we are today, because you look at what Biddle did with Jody and the knowledge that those two acquired together, not only because Jody drove the cars and Biddle worked on the cars to begin with, then he drove cars, and the knowledge that you have there is much like Kyle Busch. You can't take that away. You can't unknow what you know. And what they've learned over the years is how to go faster.
This Hall of Fame does have a tradition of family, does it? Right?
You know, it very much the driver does, but you goes find in, out how much family's involved, just like Karen with Captain Herb. You find out how involved families are, but that's how it had to be, because otherwise you'd be sitting home by yourself all the time while somebody else is out doing something else. So you get involved or you find something else to do, and most everybody did it together as a family, and the ones I think that did it together, the best as a family, succeeded as a family.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about this past week on the podcast, on was episode 68, I think, about Darrell Waltrip and, you know, his wife Stevie being at the track from the very beginning.
Well,
and
Michael being, I mean, just the fact that the family's around and you're able to share some of this stuff that you're doing and what you've experienced, because you've always got somebody that you can go up to and ask a question and get an honest answer. And that's something that through the racing, you don't know if you're going to get an honest answer if you go talk to one of the drivers and they really don't know you. I don't really expect an honest answer. So why help your competition?
Well, exactly. That sometimes the crew members are
I keep looking around. I'm seeing all the people that's here, and it's interesting to see all the faces here and see the people that you know.
This is like a big – it's not just a Hall of Fame induction day. It's like a –
No, it's
a
like
reunion.
A reunion day. Yeah, exactly.
We need really Rick Manor here. The main audience are the past inductees of their families.
We need Rick Manor here with a load of watermelons or onions or something.
And Rick Manor will be – and Rick Manor is instrumental, especially in getting the voting process together and
that's
finding
it.
The drivers,
that's
the information. He and Mike Bell are the historians of the information pipes, and then you've got the great volunteers here like Faye Abercrombie and her husband and many others. And then,
your sister-in-law, Cindy, does
a lot of the coordination as well, and all of them together have been instrumental in getting this library up and running next to us. One thing I wanted to mention about the family is something that's totally foreign to someone like me in the digital age is
– I don't think anything's foreign to you in the digital age.
Well, but – is how in the past there used to be, and they pointed it out at Sonoma Raceway. I was out there with PRN this past weekend, and they pointed to this one box, and they said, this box right here, that's NASCAR timing and scoring, all the rows used to be filled with the wives, girlfriends, sisters, kids, whoever, that had to do the manual scoring.
That's it.
What was that? Now, you were on the pit box, but what did they actually – have to
we
do.
Didn't have a pit box.
Well, the pit area.
Pit wall.
You were in the pit wall.
Yeah, we're in the pit wall. The man with the plan right there. Randy, how are you doing? We need to talk to you. You come on over.
Yeah, come on over, yeah. Since we're getting
but anyway,
today.
You were,
so, but what are they – so they had to – they were writing down numbers next to the flag stand on a piece of paper to make sure that their driver's laps were getting counted, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's crazy to think they did that by hand, and each lap
they had
to be
what they
engaged.
Call a flop clock, and the flop clock ran every time your driver crossed a particular point. You wrote the number down that was on the flop clock, so that's
flop
how you
clock.
Kept up with your times and your laps and position. And that was no easy job. Morris Metcalf was the one that ran that deal when we first started, and I don't know how on God's green earth they kept up with anything.
Well, there have been entire race wins. Brett Bodine, this was only in 1989 or 90. Brett Bodine's race win at wherever it was, Rockingham, I think, he was not on the lead lap and he won the race. And it was actually, I think, a Darrell Waltrip win. That was really highly disputed.
Yeah, there were probably a lot of questionable races that we still don't know if we went back in time who won the race or not. But I'm amazed that they did as well as they did.
Oh, absolutely.
Considering what they had, because NASCAR kept up with your position, but you also had a representative from your team that kept up with your position also. So if on the scoreboard and they had a list of positions, if there was a discretion in position then whoever scored for you could say, well, I protest this because this don't line up with this. But now it's all electronic, and with the transponders the cars have and the way that you can score, just like we did at Gresham, we not only could score laps, we knew what the corner times were.
Right.
We knew your position on the racetrack at six different places on the racetrack. So we
could keep
up.
It was more exact than at a NASCAR track, if I remember
correctly.
Yeah,
but don't turn my power off, because once we turn my power off, then I'm like you. I don't know who's where.
Yeah. I did some announcing, I think two or three races at Hartwell Speedway last year, and that was totally different. I mean, they had to manually keep score, and it was a totally
score.
And you know, you don't have 30 cars out there, so you know who's, as the announcer, I know who's leading.
No, but you get beyond 10 cars, and I can't count anymore.
Exactly. So. Well, let's bring in somebody who I know has seen it all at short tracks all over the South there. Really impressive resume. One of our 2019 Georgia Racing Hall of Fame inductees, Randy Holt, is in the house, ladies and gentlemen.
Woo-hoo!
What is going on? How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Good to have you. You might be, and no offense to you, Dan, because you looked great too, but you might be the best dressed of the inductees that I've seen in the few years I've come to do this.
I can't wait to see Billy Ballou. What do you think Billy will be wearing?
I asked him if he was going to wear a sport coat with them shorts, and he said, well, no, I'm not going to wear my shorts. That's what he said.
Wow.
Okay. Now, process is the limit. We're thinking he means wearing pants, right? Not no
yeah.
shorts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Look who's in the house.
There, Rick Minner's rolled up in here. So
Yeah. Did he bring any watermelons?
Now, we're gonna smash those in victory lane. So, Randy, how many years has this been coming? I mean, how many years have you been on the list? Or when did you first think, oh, I could maybe actually be in this Hall
of Fame? On the good list.
you know, that was the first time that my name had been submitted. And
that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. It's a true honor. When I first retired in 99 Jack Jackson said, you need to get all your statistics together and let's get your name submitted. Well, I never did do it. And I'm really glad that I didn't, because it means more to me now than it would have then, really.
Mm-hmm.
And my son, he kept saying, you need to be in the Hall of Fame. I said, well, I must not. I'm not in it. So anyway, he put all of the –
I'm glad other people have more faith in you than you do in you.
It is tough, though. You have any ounce of humility, you don't want to go campaigning for yourself. You really need somebody who believes in you to push that forward.
Right.
I mean, Dan, didn't you say you didn't even know?
I had no idea, and I appreciate all that was done for me, as well as I know Randy does for what was done for him. Because, yeah, if it wasn't for the efforts of other people, this sounds kind of stupid, but in this respect, no, I didn't want to go out tooting my own horn. And as much as in the years, you know, you do the things you do, and it makes it look like you're pushing yourself through everything. But this was kind of a different deal, and it makes it to me more of an honor when it's that way, because other people think that much of you to do that, something that you probably wouldn't have done for yourself.
Right. Mm-hmm. There was no way that I was going to do it myself.
Yep.
It's better. I mean, it's good that it was my son, but it could have been somebody.
It's
that
more
was
an
a
honor
yeah,
when, it,
right.
when it's your son.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I read on here, and that, to me, this is, first off, you know, this goes back, is this approximately 150 feature wins, all right?
Yeah.
Do you know the exact number? Is this one of those where you won a bunch of races over the years and we just kind of rounded up or down?
A lot of them we do, but, you know, it's just his memory's a lot better than mine, as far as he could remember a lot of things that I couldn't remember. But see, I have one car, the car that I've got in here right now. I won 97 races with that car.
That one car.
One car, yep. It was a good one.
Wow.
Yep.
Did you race that car till the end? At what point did you stop racing that car?
Well, the last time I raced, I raced that car. The one is sitting in here now, and it looks...
How many years did you run that same car?
I got it from Port City Racing in Michigan in 1990.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the chassis is that old. And, I mean, we'd update shocks and springs and, you know, sometimes different spindle angles and that, you know, he's all the time changing things. But it's got a 97 T-Bird body on it now. You know, when I quit, you know, we were racing Taurus, and Taurus made a good-looking race car, but I never thought of a four-door car as a race car. So that's the reason I kept the Thunderbird. Well, I kept the Thunderbird really because I won that many races with it, yeah.
That's so cool. That's so cool. Now, what do you do over the year? What do you do with 150 trophies or plaques or whatever they give you? I mean, I don't know.
Well, you didn't always get a trophy unless it was a special race. If it's a special race, you got trophies, but just a weekly race, or a lot of times there wasn't a trophy involved, just, you know, money. Yeah.
Very little money.
Yeah. Well, that's what people don't understand. And I don't think I realized this when I first got into covering racing and just enjoying racing. I went to the Talladega Short Track with a guy that used to be on a racing show
because you never think of Talladega as having a short track.
Yeah, it's got
anywhere
a little dirt track. I went there to cover the main race.
The short track would be Pitt Road the short track.
There's this guy named Jamie Sims I went to college with, and his younger brother Mark raced. And so Mark and his dad Charlie went to the racetrack, and I sat with him for a whole night at Talladega Short Track running. I don't even remember which late model class. It was definitely not the Supers. All right, it was one of the crate divisions. They raced, were out there all day, towed out there from Douglasville, and got $25.
Yep.
You know, and this was in 2008 or something, or 2009. This was not even in the 70s. It really is a passion.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we probably went to a lot of races that we didn't even get the $25.
That's right. Sure did.
Yeah.
But I always had good sponsors, and that meant a lot. I did, you know.
Yeah, Mike Helton was sponsoring you then, wasn't he?
Mike's first race car.
what's the story? I hear you. Well, Mike, what's the story here?
What's that? Tell it, Randy.
I don't know.
Or what you can tell. I don't know. But you said Mike Helton, right? Like the.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that wrong. Okay, so
you didn't hear that wrong.
And for those that don't know, Mike Helton used to be the president of Atlanta Motor Speedway.
Right.
He has big time Georgia roots.
Right.
So.
Talladega was Talladega first, wasn't he? Then came to Atlanta,
was it backwards? No, he was Atlanta first.
Atlanta first, yeah, then went to Talladega.
He left there and went to work for the Francis, and then he went first to Daytona and then to Talladega.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and he ran Talladega. Mike and I have been friends
forever.
Years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are we going to see a Mike Helton appearance today? Because we better clean up our act, Dan, if Mike Helton's coming.
Right. He's surprising me because he told me that he'd like to be here. But I knew they were running at Chicago, and I didn't figure he'd make it. And he told me that it wasn't going to work out. But now I don't know if he just done that.
I hope it'll surprise you.
Well, we'll know.
That would be a big surprise.
He's not somebody that can sneak in places.
He can do pretty doggone good at sneaking into places. That's for sure.
Well, now, so Dan, okay, let's zoom out a little bit. In 2010, your first full year that Gresham is open and you're the president and GM, and you run the NASCAR K&N E-Series race. What was that like knowing that Mike Helton, Lisa France Kennedy are going to be there, and the other NASCAR brass that are executed that race?
You know, I think for anyone, that's what I want to get into Randy a little bit about how instrumental Mike was, because no one knows this about Mike and how many people he's really helped through the years, and very little is known about that, and Mike will not say very much about it. He's just not that kind of person.
Yeah.
So to have all of the France family there was, to me, that track was built for NASCAR whenever it first opened in the 60s. And to have them back there was an incredible, incredible day to me. And we took a lot of photos and stuff because that was going to be a moment that I was hoping that we could eventually go to the point that we would have a truck race there and maybe get to the point that we could have a Bush race, Xfinity race, whatever, but it was one of those deals where I hope this would be what would open up the door to be something fantastic later down the road.
And
it just wasn't meant to be. But Mike, being in your career early, how did Mike help you the most in the beginning?
Well, we got to be a real good friendship, because see, Mike I was doing all the electrical work at Atlanta Motor Speedway. AIR.
So that was your AIR. Main your and, main gig during the week was you're an electrician.
Yeah, electrical okay. contract. Yeah. Yeah. And then Mike, Mike would put his suit on and go out and try to sell Atlanta Raceway, mm-hmm. and then he'd have to come back in the afternoons. That's when we worked for Walt. You know how Walter Nix was.
Walt was kind of
old school,
scraping nickels and pennies together. Yeah,
and Mike would have to put on his coveralls and get on the tractor and bush hog
and cut grass.
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. But Mike, I don't think Mike Helton has really got the credit that he deserves.
No.
Really.
I don't know. I mean, I've followed this. The first race I watched all the way through was the 2001 Daytona 500, the one that I really started paying attention to. And that was his first as president, I believe, or one of his – yeah, I think that was the year he became president. And he had to make that announcement after. And even since then, I've followed now for, what was that, 18 years ago? What? And I still don't know a lot about that history. I just know what he's done as president of NASCAR.
What speaks volumes to me about Mike Helton is the fact that – to me, I think there's three people that are running the sport right now, and I look at Jim France, Lisa France, and Mike Helton.
Yeah.
And I don't see one any different from the other. Where you see one, you see the other two. Yeah. So I look at Mike being probably the most stabilizing force in those people, more so than Brian France for sure, but I see him as the stabilizing force of those people that have helped this sport to come to the level it's come to today.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. You know, Mike, let me tell you one thing.
Let's hear it.
I told him, I said, you know, if I'd have known that when you left Atlanta that you was going to go as far as you went, I said, I'd have followed along behind you. I said, there's got to be some kind of job you can find me in NASCAR. And he said, Not until I don't need any more electrical work. As long as I'm going to still need some electrical work, you're not going to have a job with NASCAR.
That's awesome.
See, he's got a big farm over there close to Atlanta.
And right,
I've done
County.
All the electrical work on that thing, and so I guess I won't never get that NASCAR job. So.
Well, you know, that's probably just as well. It seems like your legacy is firm and well without having to
work
for the
last hour.
Yeah,
he might have done you a favor by keeping you out of it.
You may have.
May have, yeah.
Hey, if you don't mind here, I'd like to talk about the last two inductee. And then I want to talk to you about Jimmy Mosseller and Captain Herb as well. So we have Bob Wright, who started racing all the way back in 1957. He had a couple of feature wins at 61, and then he teamed up with another fellow Hall of Fame driver, Bob Berkham, and won 56 of the 60 races they entered in 1962, and another 34 races, and barely lost a national NASCAR modified title to Bobby Allison in that year, too. Did y'all have any dealings with Do you have any dealings with Bob Wright at all?
I didn't know him.
That's incredible, and he's being inducted posthumously there, passing away in 2014. Our driver of the year is Bubba Pollard, who has already won this award before, and it seems like each year, just make it Bubba. He just continues. I'm thinking, is this a fairy tale or what? At some point, you got to go. But it reminds me a lot of what we read about you winning 150 races in a short time.
Yeah.
I know you and I, Dan, have you dealt with Bubba at all over the years, or are you out of the sport?
I remember his father, you know, when I was racing at Sonoma and his father was racing there. But Bubba is, I keep up with him. He's really good. It's a shame, you know, he was close to getting a NASCAR deal at one time. Wasn't he under Roush? Wasn't he in that program,
I think? He was in that program, and it just never did come through. But, you know, you look at what he's done in his career, and not only has he done it here close around, because a lot of times you can stay at one track, and that's the thing that we admired the most about Jody was the fact that he traveled a lot of different racetracks, and he was successful at a lot of different racetracks, which means that you can get good at your home track if you run there enough and keep.
Yeah.
It's not that you are bad or you can't do good anywhere else, because budget dictate where you go to.
Right.
But a lot of times the true deal was in going to other racetracks and especially where you had a driver go to Alabama and run against the Allisons.
Yeah.
And that was hard to do because that was their home turf, and they weren't going to let any outsiders come in and beat them on their home turf. And that's the way we felt about our home turf here. Right. No outsiders were going to come in, but it happens.
Last fall, Bubba Pollard, for the first time, well, he did he, in the last couple
well,
of years,
what,
and he's only in his early 30s,
right.
All right? And he's already like, well, I've done all that. Let me try something new. Mm-hmm. And he's only in his early 30s where some people haven't even begun their kind of hobby race. I know it's not a hobby for him, but they haven't even begun that short track race and stuff until, you know, until later in life. And Bubba has done this so long, he's like, I'm going to get ambitious and go out west.
That's
and
it.
I'm going to win Kern County Raceway and Canadian and Canada Short Track Nationals and run up in Michigan. But here's the one that really got me. He didn't have to go far to do something for the first time either. He went up to Martinsville late September, the same weekend as the Roval, and that 300-miler you know, Cowabunga Bonanza, you know, the biggest short track race just about in the country.
Dude.
Yeah, a short track race in the country. And darn near won that thing, too. He actually got wrecked out by Scott Wimmer's kid, or Scott Riggs's kid, Lane. And Bubba Pollard, even in something where the other people are completely, I mean, that's their biggest race. He got in a late model stock, which does race differently than the late models he runs, and almost won at Martinsville.
That's the
incredible.
Hard part of short track racing is when you leave your home turf and you go somebody else's turf and you try to beat them at their own game, and it's hard to do. But when you can do it, you leave with a whole different attitude about what you can go somewhere else and do, because all you got to do is throw the money up and you've got a lot of good drivers. And that's the thing I missed most about today is, you know, as they say in NASCAR, me and Doug talk about it all the time, if somebody's winning all the time, just throw a bounty on them and put the purse out there and let's go for the money, because you throw the money and it's like red flag in front of the bull and everybody wants to go get the money.
Yeah, that'd be nice to see. A couple of other awards being handed out today. I know there's a volunteer award being handed out later. The Jimmy Mosteller Media Award goes to Motorsport America's Fred Hanion, who I have seen ever since I've started covering racing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like every racing event I manage to drag myself to, Fred's drug himself there a day earlier, his day's a day longer. All right, he's somebody that not only goes out of his way to photograph races all over the country and all different disciplines. He was at almost every Gresham race, set in a stack of free publications. It's all
and
sponsored.
And he's a nice guy.
And he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he's from the north.
Yeah.
Okay, how about that? No, but
another oxymoron.
But, so that but Fred Hanion is a great dude, and Motorsport America is a really cool magazine. So props to him for the Jimmy Mosteller Media Award. And also the Pioneer Award goes to a driver who became a journalist, Bernard Long, who, among many things, at the age of 28, he ran his first race in 1941 at Lakewood Speedway and actually won on the Daytona Beach Road Course. He's getting the inaugural Pioneer Award today. So very cool. So if you don't mind, before we wrap up here, because we got our induction, it starts at 1 o'clock. It's almost 12:15 now. We're going to do one more thing. We wanted to bring Karen Emery over real fast if we can and talk. And I really appreciate you joining, Randy. Thank you so much and congrats for today. We want to bring Karen Emery over to have a seat to
Ford
talk about
Blue.
The other big part of our ceremony, the Jimmy Mosteller and Captain Herb Emery Library dedication there. It might be helpful here. Hand me that mic, Karen, because I'm afraid we're going to feedback on that speech. It might be helpful to come sit down. So, and I'm sorry, I didn't leave a good space for you to get in there.
No, you just stand there and be pretty.
I apologize. I was afraid we'd be getting the kind of feedback we don't want.
She might want stereo.
So, no, I don't.
Okay. I love surprises, and for several years we've talked about this library, and it finally came to fruition this year. And I think they're toying with me a little bit. They sent me a little tiny sliver of a picture, and I'm thinking, cool, we'll get a nice little display. And then, Karen, I get here today, about 30 minutes before you do, I look up, and we get a whole trailer dedicated to Jimmy Mosteller and Captain Herb. You went to, I'm guessing, many races where they were both at the same place doing announcement at the same time. What did you know, before we talk about Herb's legacy, what did you know of, and Dan also, of Jimmy Mosteller? I only got to meet him maybe once.
Jimmy was an incredible man. I remember the old Peach Bowl reunions that were done down on the south side of town. Probably.
See, they never let me go to any of the reunions at Peach Bowl.
I can't imagine why. But
because I stopped at the varsity. I never made it to the Peach Bowl.
He kept going to the Punch Bowl.
I kept going to the Peach Bowl.
Jimmy was just is a legend. I mean, he's a legend. And to see him
and the walking, kindest man,
just a
gentleman,
spirit.
Just a true Southern gentleman.
Yes, absolutely.
All the time you ever saw him.
Absolutely. Knew
only
everyone.
The cigar every time you saw him.
That's what I was going to say at the Peach Bowl reunions. Mm. He walked around with that little cigar hanging out of his mouth for doing Have a Tampa series for how long? But it was a privilege and an honor to know Jimmy, to be around him. He always made you feel like family whenever you had the opportunity to spend any time with him. His lovely wife.
But how much this mirrors what Karen and Captain Herb.
Well, exactly
It's amazing to me the similarities of the two and how they made you feel, both feel so welcome no matter what you were doing or what you had to say or what the day was. It was always about you. It wasn't about them. It was always about
yes.
you.
Yes,
because it truly was always about you.
I know that.
We considered it an honor and
you made everyone feel special.
Well,
that was
appreciate
awesome.
That, but
she
that's because
does.
You all are special. And
the thing I regret the most is not knowing all the things that Captain Herb was involved in. As I talked about, he was like an iceberg. 7/8 of him was below the water. You never knew what was going on with him, with you, and what y'all were doing behind the scenes.
The selfie age was not made with Captain Herb in mind. Let's put it that way.
No. So. No. And, you know, truly, Herb believed that was part of being a giver, is that you didn't have to broadcast everything that you did. As a matter of fact, he shied away from that.
Well, that's kind of what the good book talks about, isn't it? Never let the right hand know what the left hand's doing.
That's pretty much it. Yep.
So. And the other thing, too, I feel like with, and I didn't know Jimmy as well, but he sounds the same build. But what I loved about Herb, and I think what I really came to appreciate about Herb even more after his passing 5 years ago, was that he saw all the things that we knew about him, the fame, if you will, the privileges that you get to have interactions with race car drivers and all those things, as this huge gift. And the only thing you could do with that gift is to pay it forward. You don't hoard it up in the storehouse back there. That's another, you know, biblical parable, right? Store up the stuff in the field, okay? No, you pay it forward. And that's why, and then that gave him that 7/8 not to know about. The 1/8 you knew about was that blessing that he was paying forward with the 7/8, I guess.
Way to look at it, Jack.
that's a real inspiration to myself and a lot of my coworkers too.
And so, he paid it forward with Doug.
Absolutely.
Well,
he
how blessed can we
absolutely.
Be?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I can't believe
blessed.
How what an honor it was to get to work alongside him. And I walk in that deal over there, and it's the first time in several years I'd seen his sound machine from the racing show, and thinking about every Saturday. I didn't have that many jobs because Herb knew how to do everything, and Herb would bring in his gym bag full of cords and sound machine, and I had to run and get the sound machine out and then hook it into the two XLR cable. Yeah, right? It was like hook it into the two XLR cables in the studio, and I'm looking at it going, just a stinking sound machine that with no electrical cord is just a brick. It's nothing. Means so much, and it reminds me so much of my first –
There were days that things went wrong.
7 to 10 years at WSB.
Yeah.
So.
But what was amazing about Jimmy and Captain Herb was the fact that it was amazing to me they knew so much about most everyone that raced. How did y'all – I don't know how Jimmy did it. I don't know how Captain Herb did it. But
before the internet too, right?
Before information was readily available, they knew so much about the different teams – or about experiences or personal things that they talked about and would relay to through the broadcast. And it's remarkable that both mirrored each other that way, that they knew so much about what was going on in an age that information was hard to get.
I agree with that. But I also think that they both had such a love and passion for racing that – regardless of, you know, not having internet and that, and the time Herb spent with his dad growing up, going to all the tracks and everything, just kind of laid that foundation. And you know as well as I do, if it's something that's important to you, you find a way to find out about it. So
that same knowing, if you will, I think, led to those lasting relationships that Herb had. So if you go in there and look at the pictures, I was FaceTiming with my girlfriend Momo right before the show, so I wanted her to see, this is what I'm up to today, all right? And I zoomed in on the different pictures that you just brought up here, Karen. Herb with Richard Petty, Rex White, David Reagan. Trying to think of who, but just those names alone. And to think he knew David from when David was a teenager, a kid, just starting Legends Cars, and invested in David and all the way to see him come up to this level. He knew Bill just as Bill was becoming a superstar.
These photos that will, and there'll be a lot more that will come, are going to speak volumes about the relationships, the personal relationships, the close friends that y'all had together through his career. It's going to speak volumes.
I think so, because quite frankly, it was, so exciting for us. And I have a ton of memories, never being in the racing world, never having any interest in it until I met Herb, to be perfectly honest.
Well, yeah.
But now, when I think of the relationships I've developed with you and
wouldn't take the world
others,
for them.
Absolutely.
Yep. They mean so much.
Another cool thing that they have here in this Jimmy Mosteller Captain Herb library is they've got a hard drive that's running several videos on loop of Captain Herb doing an interview on Douglas County's cable access channel, an interview that he does in the Mayberry patrol car right outside of the Hall of Fame here for this website, this car website. And then there's also a tribute video that Laura Lawson, who's a big-time WSB listener and big-time sim racer, put together with a bunch of Captain Herb. It's a collage, essentially, or a slideshow of photos, and then a bunch of sound clips that we sent her. You get to see all of those. If you want to go stand in that trailer for about 40, 45 minutes, you can actually watch all of those and hear that familiar voice. once again.
Wonderful
so
memories.
It's really cool. And for those that haven't been here before, so I only know
three words made him famous. So
what's that?
Three words made him famous. Kyle the Pile.
Kyle the Pile. See, I was thinking, oh, my aching big toe is more than three. Kyle the Pile.
I love to aggravate him about Kyle Busch.
Yes.
Made the hair stand up on
okay.
the back of his head.
We can say this. This is okay. I just remember. So, Karen, you remember this sort of tension I had, I guess, maybe if that's the best word, of the racetrack.
Doug
I was like
Pence.
22 years yeah. old and wanting to leave a good impression on people and make it somehow, whatever that means in the race. And so we'd go up there and set up Herb's show. And I'm wanting, during the whole, most of the weekend.
How naive can you get?
I'm sitting in the media center being the, you know, good little kid and all that stuff, you know, and all that stuff. And then we set up the racing show, and then the drivers are walking to the driver's meeting, and Herb's got the PA system, you know, just like we got set up here, turned on. Goes, oh, there goes Kurt the Jerk. There goes Kurt and Kyle the Pile. And he's yelling out while they're, and I'm going, Herb, shut up. And I was like, sort of, you know.
And this was
not that
your
I was
mentor.
Ever embarrassed to be around Herb, but I was like, Herb.
Some of those were mild compared.
Yeah, well, those were the ones that got said out loud. Yeah, yes.
Tell us the rest of the story.
So, yeah. And what was so cool is Karen, we talked about, Karen was the call screener of our show. All right, so Karen would sit there and have to talk to the same, let's say, you know, Randy from Rex and Robbie from Red Oak and Reggie from Fayetteville. I'm trying to, and then you'd take the calls
from
Ben Wright, Rick Minter, Mark Garrow.
I thought Karen kept the program G-rated was what.
Well, that I think the funniest is when we first started, before we started doing the race show, and Herb asked me if I would screen and co-produce the show just so we'd be able to spend, you know, some time together.
Oh, absolutely.
But whenever he would make me angry, I would tell him that I could put every one of those phones on hold and he wouldn't get any calls and he would have to add them. And
and he knew where he'd
for
find
two
the phone.
Hours, yes.
And there were some times where Karen and Crystal Wheeler, our board operator, or Jennifer Griffiths, the news anchor, we've done enough calls today, and even though the walls are soundproof, there are very few things that can make it through the soundproof walls of WSB Studios.
Except
but Karen
us.
And Crystal carrying on a conversation was one of those things, and you could hear them there just raising hell. It was great.
Yep. All right. On another note here.
I'm saying those were. I look forward to those Saturdays. So you talk about making people feel special. you know, we all worked all week, and I looked forward to Saturday because from 12 to 2 usually is when we were on,
we
or 3
had
to 5.
Fun.
We had a great time.
We had fun.
Well, I think the most important part of this is no matter what happens, life is real. And you, when you get down to being passionate about anything, that passion shows through,
absolutely,
no matter what. So you have opinions, and you get passionate about the opinions, and you think about it, end of the show, you went home, and that's life.
That's right.
I also love, too, so, Eddie, you talk about this tension.
Again, I'm very young,
and I'm trying to think about how, I guess I'm thinking, okay, I want to have – not be serious totally. I love the humor, but I was thinking, let's have a Herb, I'm going to produce for you. I'm going to try to structure the show, and I would try to, like, come up with this sheet that he, you know, and he never used any, you know, I would come up with all these sound clips that he never used it. But I love that he didn't, because that freed him up to do things like, let's go back to the sound machine.
Yes.
Let's go back to the sound machine in there, the instant replay at the end of the newscast. You remember this, Dan? At the end of the newscast, News Talk 750 WSB, and between WSB and Depend on It, Herb would play sound effects. He'd play boiling water or a lady screaming, and there was only one news anchor that really objected to that, Charlie O'Brien, and he came in and told me to tell Herb to not do that. I was like, "You're looking at me, bro."
Yeah, because he thought you were naive enough that you might go ask.
And Karen, you remember what he did for Jennifer, right?
Yes.
Is that all you want to say? So Jennifer Griffiths, who has a fuse shorter than an Oompa Loompa, okay? And Jennifer Griffiths has this, it's famous for her temper.
Jennifer, if you're listening, we love you, okay?
We love Jennifer.
Yes, we do.
But he goes, now, wait a second, Jennifer, still in the news booth, she's got something she wants to play for us, do for us. And it was somebody doing the armpit fart songs. And it was, like that. And Herb, and it was like a minute long. And he yelled, Jennifer, great job. And, of course, she's in there just living.
It was
perfect. There he is, Mr. Densmore.
He was awful. To poor Jennifer, he would put coat racks in front of the newsroom door so she couldn't get in or out when she was doing her reports. Or if she was late running in there, he'd have all of his stuff piled up in front. He was vicious with Jennifer, and she was always a good sport after she had her
say. So you're saying...
You can also hear her through the windows,
you're
too,
saying you didn't want to get on the bad side of Captain Herb.
No.
Okay. I think, though, if you were on his good side is when that stuff
that's
really
when
happened.
He did it.
Yeah.
That's when he joked with you, is when you were on his good side, because he loved Jennifer.
I tried to do one on him one time.
I don't recognize Billy
Ballou. Oh, look, at Billy Ballou is here, ladies and gentlemen. We need to get him over here on the show. But before I let you go, okay. I tried to Pete Combs, his wife was working for M&M's and had some Kyle Busch cutouts. And so we stuck one in Herb's cubicle, and we stuck one in the studio right before the show. And I was expecting her to go in there, you know, oh, what is he? And Herb just looked at it one time and punched it in the face and just moved on. Just barely even, he just went, bop.
That's because he knew what you wanted.
Exactly.
Him to do.
Yeah. Like, come on, man. How many times have I flipped out when you pulled jokes on me, like lying to me and telling me that AMS pulled my credentials 1 year because they didn't like what I wrote? And like,
Captain Herb was also a psychologist, wasn't he?
Yeah. And then he would totally turn around and be like, oh, okay.
Yep. That was Herb.
It was perfect. But I bet he was just fun as a kid. Don't you think?
I think he was what mother would call a little crap.
Yeah. Good save.
Always
good
in
save.
Trouble.
Well, I see Billy Ballou's rolled in. A lot of our other inductees have rolled in here. And so we're getting ready to wrap up here in just a few moments. I do want to announce, if we can get Billy on, we'll do that. If not, we've told a lot about Billy, so he's done a lot. But October the 25th through 27th, the Mountain Moonshine Festival is going once again. And I came up here, I don't know how many years they've been doing that, but I came up in 2009, I think it was, and it was a pretty big festival. I
you
came
don't know
up
how
last
many
year.
Years they've been doing that?
No, I don't know how many years they've been doing
it. I think the first year was 1967.
Really?
I think it was the first year.
I feel like just in 10 years, it's...
I've been here 20 years.
It's gone nuts.
Because it rained, you know, it's like the first year was like 2 years, and the second year was like 1 year, but
that's
the
true.
Third year was like 4 years. So.
But it's a lot of fun.
Well, and it benefits care, right? So
it
benefits
care.
Can you explain care real quick, Dan, and what that because it's not just
I know it supplies a lot of needy kids and a lot of needy families Christmas for the kids. So it's a real worthwhile cause, and I commend the people that have kept this going and what they're trying to do to help these kids have a great Christmas.
That's wonderful.
We're all about that.
And much
that.
Like Toys for Tots,
yes.
Same thing. It's all about the kids, and we just want the kids to have a great Christmas, and that's what it benefits. And that was lost for a long time in what Moonshine Festival was. And that's what I told Doug. I said, this is the positive side of it, and this is what we're trying to do.
I love it.
If you've got a business or want to be a vendor or something like that, you can reach out to just Google Moonshine Mountain Festival and get in touch with people, contact them, and I'm sure they'd be happy to sign you up because they have rows and rows now. It goes all the way through downtown Dawsonville. They pretty much shut the town down for about 3 straight days. And we came up last year on the Saturday and
it's like
had
a cheap sewer system. It just gets stopped up.
Well, that's a good way to put a positive spin on that. So on that note,
just gets plugged
since it's
up.
Almost lunchtime, that note, I guess we'll go ahead and take this one into the
system,
garage.
It's about
here.
Lunchtime.
Exactly. So I'll take it into the garage here, but I'm really interested. By the way, Karen, I saw Cindy had more photos of things she was putting in there, so it's getting more dressed up. I'm looking forward to seeing what the inside of the trailer looks like since I last sat down, but
It's beautiful.
That's good.
Beautiful.
So we'll definitely be looking at that. And then in about 30 minutes here, we're going to get the inductions underway and dedicate this library.
Yeah, you got to go to work. Enough of the fun stuff here. You got to go to work.
Just like anything else, just like when Herb did this many years, passion.
Yes.
Passion. So.
Absolutely.
So anyway, for Randy Fuller, who was over here a moment ago, Karen Emery, and, of course, Dan Elliott, Doug Turnbull here. We're so glad y'all tuned in for this bonus episode of Five to Go for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I can say thank y'all very much for tuning in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, some of y'all been hanging on there for Facebook quite a while. Thanks to Joe Williams, by the way, my mentor.
He needs to turn it around and face the camera and everybody can know who he is.
They're like, oh, that's Joe.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Yeah. But anyway,
that's like my fondest memories of Karen.
But congrats.
You're not taking a picture of me.
Exactly. Very elusive. But congrats to Billy Ballou, Tammy Joker.
I wouldn't have known her if
Randy
it wasn't
Holt.
Me.
I said Fuller by mistake earlier. So Randy Holt, Biddle Ridley, Bob Wright, and Bubba Pollard, Driver of the Year,
yes.
Moss Stellar Media Award Winner of the Year, Fred Hanion, and Pioneer Award Winner Bernard Long.
Congratulations to all the inductees.
It should mention Captain Herb, the first ever winner of the Jimmy Moss Stellar Media Awards, so fitting their libraries up together.
Absolutely.
But Jimmy and Captain Herb were so much alike in their personalities and their mannerisms and stuff. It's just remarkable when you think back on them.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, we're glad y'all tuned in, and we'll see y'all soon. We'll be up here live again, hopefully in October. So
I hope I'll be live.
See y'all there. Take care, y'all.